Jesus is the only way to have peace with God. Though there is only one way to God, everyone's journey to Jesus is unique and magnificent. Here is a story of one's journey to Christ, now on Redemption Report. Welcome to this week's episode of Redemption Report. Today I have a friend that I actually just got to meet in person for the first time, but I've known for several years. We've talked over the years, played fantasy football. And so, Brad, welcome to Redemption Report today.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So like I said, we started playing fantasy football. I know you were part of a league with an old college roommate of mine through a church connection, like historically. How long have you been in that league? Because I think you and I have been in the league for 6-7 years at this point.
Yeah. I think maybe... probably just maybe 2 or 3 years before you joined.
Okay.
So maybe like 8 or 9 years. It was, it started as, I was in a small group. It was referred to as a house church.
Okay.
And all of the guys, plus, you know, some friends, relatives, cause we didn't have enough for a league. I think when we first started, it was like 12 teams.
Okay.
And then we lost some people and then we needed new blood, and they, your friend invited you to come join.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's how we
I was just met. Visiting him at his house down in South Carolina, and he's like, do you play fantasy football? And I was like, I like to. And then he's like, oh, you should join our league. And it was actually, it's cool how God worked it out, because I was really in need of, like, community at that point. Not that fantasy football is the biggest community, especially when you're all remote. But over the years, it's been really good. You know, you and I have been able to... talk about a variety of subjects, and a couple other guys. So, yeah, it's been cool how God has used that and even allowing you to be here today.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm not too far away, about an hour north of where you are, so it was nice that... I mean, you always talk about how you're a Cowboys fan or, you know, your other sports teams are all Colorado. So I didn't know that you lived so close by. I thought you lived out in Colorado.
Well, that's where I originally lived, and then God brought me out this way. But yeah, it is pretty cool to be this close. But first time ever being together in person, so I'm glad it worked out.
Me too.
Can you tell us just a little bit, because, you know, I'm still getting to know you as well, who you are today and kind of if someone would say who's... Brad, how do you pronounce your last name?
You pronounce it like the T is silent, Brobeck.
Brobeck, okay.
It's technically Brotbeck. It's German. I'm from Swiss heritage. It means bread baker, Brotbeck.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Do you live up to your name in any way, shape, or form?
No, I'm not a baker.
Okay.
I do like to cook. I'm a griller. I don't know if there's a German word name for that.
Okay.
But, yeah, so... I am a husband and a father, been married 18 years coming up July 1st.
Congratulations, that's cool.
My daughter, her name is Emelina. She's going to be 12 in August. And my wife, Cassie, and I met at church. And I guess that story will come later because that's about more of who I was. But I currently work. I work in a county government job in Ohio, and I work with benefits planning, like and you know, Medicaid, cash and food assistance, and work with like all age levels and things like that. So I've been doing that for 7 years, and that's kind of like my career path has been more like along the social work. Like helping people. I've worked with at-risk youth and homeless individuals in the past. So, and that's kind of like my, what you call tent making.
Yeah.
I work to do a job so that I can serve the church. It's really important to me. And I teach a young adult Sunday school class where I attend church now. And I just started teaching again this past January.
Okay.
It's something that I'm passionate about, and it's not a job to me, so I enjoy preparing for it and doing it. So
you're also a big movie guy.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah. I have two friends that whenever I want to talk movies with, one's in Colorado, and he was on a previous episode, but he has hundreds and hundreds of movies, and that collection has just grown over the years. Just loves it. And then we were just talking right before we started recording about your movie in-home theater collection that's grown over
yeah.
2 decades or so.
Yeah, it's
so.
Something I really like. I'm kind of like a dabbler in lots of different things, but I like pulling ideas and pulling quotes from movies when I'm teaching. But I like to watch movies critically, but I also like to just watch them for not just pure entertainment, but like, you know, what's this artist trying to say?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I went through a phase probably like a lot of people who are film buffs or film nerds, like in my 20s, where I went off on like the real super indie, independent filmmaking. And I'm not much like that anymore, you know, being a dad and being a husband. I don't
it's only
really
so many hours in the day.
Exactly. Yeah. But I still have those, you know, interests. And I still, you know, when a movie I really want to see comes out, I have to go see it in the theater.
Yeah.
And then I try to reproduce that as best I can at home. So,
one of these days I'm going to have to come up and check it out since we are so close. Like, there's been a couple movies that have come out and I've been like, this is a movie I would like to watch, not just watch, but watch with someone.
Uh-huh.
You know, I don't know what your rules are about talking, but I do, you know, not talk through the whole thing, but just being able to make a comment, I think has been helpful in the past with different movies. But.
Yeah, definitely. I have some picks. I'll say, like, have you ever seen these movies? And you'll pick one. I was like, all right. We can.
Okay. So, Brad, how did you grow up in the Ohio area? Or tell us a little bit about how you were raised and your family.
So I didn't pull my phone out because I had to ask my dad a question. My dad was an Air Force brat. Actually, my grandfather was an Army Air Corps bomber pilot before there was even an Air Force. He flew something like, he flew 20-some missions in World War II in Korea. And so my dad, he went to 6 different high schools growing up. I knew it was a bunch. And he went to 2 in his senior year. My grandfather was all over the place. And my dad's the oldest, and his siblings are all, like, much younger than him.
Okay.
And my grandfather found out or was announced my dad's birth while he was on the plane, while he was in a bomber. And they have a picture of my grandfather getting the radio call that his son was born. So, and there's like a little news article about it that my dad has somewhere. And so he was all over the place. And I was a little bit all over the place early in life. I was born in Pennsylvania. We moved to Virginia. And then my dad, he was a civilian working for the Air Force in the Air Force Audit Agency. And so he got stationed at Torrejon Air Force Base in Madrid, Spain.
Okay.
When I was 5. And we were there almost 3 years.
Wow, okay.
And so I've lost all of my Spanish, but I was often told I was the best Spanish speaker in the house because I was so little. And, you know, when you're immersed in the language when you're so young. But I have an affinity for language even to this day. Like, I really like learning. And
that experience of being overseas is really special. I mean, I did it as an adult, but it's hard to really understand unless you've done it what impacts it has on your life.
Yeah,
so that's really cool.
So Dayton, Ohio is home to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. It's one of the largest Air Force bases in terms of personnel. It's top 5 for sure. It's a very large Air Force base. And that's what brought us to Dayton, Ohio.
Okay.
And I grew up there from the time I was 3rd grade.
Okay.
So that's when I graduated from high school. But then I went away to school. And like you, when I finished college, I went to South Korea to teach English as a second language.
Gotcha. Okay.
With Word of Life International. Did youth ministry over there.
Interesting. Okay.
And I was there a little over a year and a half.
Okay.
And I love to pick up the language. I can read and write Korean. I can say my vocabulary is okay, but my grammar is horrific. So, and my pronunciation is good.
They had their Alphabet developed later, like I think like what the 1950s.
It's one of the very
like
few fully synthetic languages. It was invented whole cloth.
Yeah, they had the spoken language, and then they created an alphabet and a character system. Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, and it's I could teach someone to read and write Korean like you could pronounce the characters. It's very simple. It looks really hard, but it's phonetic, just like English is. So. Mm-hmm. It just looks so foreign. But yeah, so I came back to the United States and I didn't know what I wanted to do. I kind of went to Korea. I wanted to serve God. I wasn't sure if I wanted to do it with missions. And I thought, well, maybe I'll go to seminary. So I attended Southern Evangelical Seminary in Charlotte, North Carolina for a year. And I was an apologetics Christian philosophy major. I skipped college. I was a Bible theology major.
Okay.
I went to a little Bible college in West Virginia, Appalachian Bible College.
Yeah, I've heard of it, yeah.
Yeah. And when I came back and I went to seminary, that was right in the year 2000. And then I came home for my brother's wedding, and a friend of mine said, "Hey, I've got a job if you're interested." And I looked at my course syllabus and how many more years I was going to have to be in school at my current pace to get a master's in apologetics that I wasn't sure was going to be very marketable, you know. And I said, well, okay, I'll think about it. And I went home, and then 9/11 happened. And it was just kind of like a wake-up call to me. I was like, oh, maybe I just need to go and do something with my life instead of just be academic and... So I came home and I started work in an inner city at-risk youth ministry.
Okay.
In a small community center. And the guy who asked me to come join him, he was with CEF, Child Evangelism Fellowship, for years. And he just did like Bible clubs like during the summer, kind of like in backyard vacation Bible school type things. But he got offered this job to do that permanently, kind of a thing, you know, youth ministry in the building. And he had all kinds of other types of ministry set up. And so I was his right-hand man for several years. I stayed with the organization that had the youth ministry for 13 years. And I kind of worked my, it was Volunteers of America, which is a sister organization of the Salvation Army. And I kind of worked my way around and did all kinds of different things, all the way to where I was the director of a 50-bed homeless veterans facility. So God took my desire to be used and to do something and like kind of shot me up.
That's awesome.
An experience to the top of a certain program. So, and then when I left that job is when I started my work for the county, and I've been there 7 years now.
Awesome. Okay. Okay. Well, that's quite the journey, you know, being able to go around. And I know, like you said, living overseas after college can kind of, it is a big deal, but also like coming back to the U.S., it can also be like, what's next? Like, I feel like for me, I stepped away and then came back and it was like, oh, well, now I'm 2 years behind everyone else. Like, I'm no longer just out of college. So, you know, entry-level positions are more challenging. Like, people look at, like, overseas work as... Some people could see it as really attractive, but a lot of people I encounter are like, that's weird. Like, why would you do that?
Yeah.
And so, that's really cool how God directed your steps and all that. Going back to your upbringing, it sounds like your parents were believers.
Yes.
So, do you remember... Obviously, you heard about it... ever since you were born, I'm sure, but do you remember the first time Jesus made sense to you, or like that you heard and understood that Jesus was someone that was personal, that you could have a relationship with?
Yeah, definitely. I felt like a lot of people who are raised in Christian homes, I kind of felt like this social pressure to like... to get with the program and be like everybody else in the family.
Okay.
And so I do definitely remember making a commitment before I really knew what I was doing. Maybe probably right before I turned 5 years old. It was before we moved over to Spain.
So it wasn't a language barrier thing.
No, it wasn't for sure. But I remember in fifth grade, I went to a Christian school, Dayton Christian School, and in a chapel service, there was a guest speaker, a pastor of a church who kind of like laid it on the line, like it was like he was speaking to me. Some of you, you know, say you believe in Jesus because that's what your parents did or what your friends did. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I interpret the parable of the narrow way as like, you have to come one at a time. Your family can't do it for you.
Yeah.
Your friends can't do it for you. Your church can't do it for you. You know, there only one person can fit through the narrow gate at a time. And so he kind of gave that message that, you know, like Paul says, examine yourself if you're in the faith. And, you know, do you really believe that Christ's sacrificial death, burial, and resurrection is the payment for your sin? Mm-hmm. And so I remember tapping the guy next to me. I still remember his name to this day. I haven't talked to him since probably seventh grade or something. Frank McGee. We kind of looked at each other. We were both thinking the same thing, and we both made a decision, you know, back in the days when altar calls were still cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, we went forward, and so I'm a double dipper. I had to get baptized again. I got baptized at a fairly young age. And after that decision, I asked, my grandfather was a minister, and I asked if he would baptize me because I believed that this was my true point of decision mm-hmm. for Christ. So
I like that application of that passage of mm-hmm. the narrow way where, you know, the broad is the way that leads to destruction. Many there are that go through it, but mm-hmm. narrow is the gate. And I like how when you tapped your buddy on the shoulder and, you know, it was kind of, sometimes you just need to encourage someone. And so mm-hmm. you also can have that confidence that mm-hmm. like, ultimately at the end of the day, you know, if none go with me, still I will follow.
Right.
But it's so much better. And, mm-hmm. and even though you go one at a time through that mm-hmm. gate, you can still have someone in front of you pulling you up mm-hmm. or, you know,
leading
supporting
you
from
yeah.
behind. So yeah, I think that's pretty cool.
And then once you get on the other side, it's all about being together.
Right.
It's all about right. being part of Christ's body.
It's just the gate that's narrow.
Right.
It's not the, the community that follows.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there are so many people in your life, even as a believer, there are so many people that you meet along the way who want to lead you through that gate of destruction. Mm-hmm. Because, hey, you know, everybody's doing it kind of thing, you know. And I'd say, you know, just kind of moving forward, like, even though I remember that distinctly, that was the time that I really made a decision for Christ, I think it's very easy, and it was easy for me, when you're raised in the church and you serve in the church, that you can just bifurcate your life into this is what I do when I'm at church and this is what I do when I'm not at church.
Yeah.
And kind of play games with God, and it's really a dangerous place to be. And I would say I did that for a while, mostly after high school. All through high school, I was so busy. I was I played the French horn. I took lessons. I was in the Dayton Youth Philharmonic. I got a scholarship to play the French horn for college. I did that for a year and decided I didn't want to do that with my life, so I changed schools. But I was so busy doing things that was good, you know, like it was a good thing. But I didn't really know what was out there and what temptations would come my way. Mm-hmm. Because I kept so busy. So after high school, I did a lot of things, just looking back. I mean, definitely regret, but God used them, even though I would, given the choice again, I wouldn't do them again. And even through the point in time where I was in South Korea and I was teaching English as a second language, I still say I was being careless with my spirit, my heart, and allowing things. You know, there's a reason why it says, you know, guard your heart, mm-hmm. for out of it flow the things of life. And it's just as much about what we let into our hearts as what we let our hearts believe and what we let our hearts think. And I just wasn't serious about that. You know, talking about being a movie guy, you know, sometimes you're tempted, like, I know this is a big thing today, like, you know, artistry, you know, requires some kind of commitment to being, I mean, sinful. I mean, mm-hmm. just to be perfectly blunt about it, you know, to serve some sort of agenda, you know. And I just believed that. I just believed that, you know, true artistry in film doesn't have any boundaries. You know, you can say and do whatever you want in film so long as it speaks something, sure. truth, you know, some kind of truth. And I allowed myself to believe those kind of things. And, you know, and my choices in my music, my choices in my friends, like, and my choices, you know, for what I did with my time, all those kinds of things. I was just really playing games for a long time. And it wasn't until, I would say, fairly recently, within the last 10 years, that God really made a change in me. Not that I didn't already believe, and not that I didn't already have salvation, but that God used what I learned growing up, scripture-wise, mm-hmm. and in school, and he did a new work in me, mm-hmm. to put it, I guess no other way to put it than that.
Yeah, and I think that's a good transition. So following your conversion, you know, you detailed different steps that you've taken and whatnot, but aside from just the movie aspect or the, you know, artistry that mm-hmm. you're talking about, what types of things changed in your life? Where I realize growing up in a Christian home and, you know, with committed parents, like, you may not have had the shock and awe of, like, some people's stories where it's like a complete radical turnaround, but there's still things in our hearts that we change or things that we have to give up. So do you remember any of that, either early on or even like you were talking about more recently, where having to kind of shift your perspective?
I do remember one time we had a converted Jew come to seminary to give a lecture, and he talked about the Jesus and the Pharisees and the woman who broke the perfume and washed Jesus' right. feet. And he said, and the phrase that, you know, he who is forgiven much, right? And he pointed out, like, the Pharisees needed to be forgiven just as much as this terrible person, this harlot or wherever she was, you know. Because God's law is like a pane of glass. It doesn't matter if you threw a cinder block through it or if you shot it with a BB, it shatters. And it's like plate glass. And so you have, as a human being, violated God's law. And your sin breaks that, no matter how big that sin was. And I remember thinking, like, I felt so fortunate because I'd been preserved from all of these horrific things. But looking back at it through that message, oh, yeah. I needed to be forgiven much. I still need to be forgiven much, and I need to behave that way, mm-hmm. that I have been forgiven much, and that I should be self-sacrificial, that I should be, you know, and just on my face before God,
yeah.
because of what he's done for me. And I remember very distinctly that, you know, along the way, you kind of take different things that you hear, you know, different messages, different books that you read that kind of influence you and change you. And I remember distinctly that being one time. I kind of forgot what
I think that's good, because even just the whole point of changing your perspective of what mm-hmm. forgiveness and even redemption looks mm-hmm. like. I think so many times you have that initial feeling of like, wow, I'm a sinner and God has saved me. Like, mm-hmm. how kind he is. But then, just like anything else, we start to go down that road and start to feel like, okay, I'm more and more a part of the club. I'm more a part of this. Mm-hmm. And then that starts to separate kind of like a me and you type scenario mm-hmm. where it's like, well, now I do things different. And so I'm having, you know, righteousness credited in my account because mm-hmm. of my actions. But you over there, you're still doing that. So I mm-hmm. must be higher and mm-hmm. low. And like you said, what that guy at your seminary conveyed, mm-hmm. you know, he is forgiven much, forgives more, not mm-hmm. Is harsher. And I feel like mm-hmm. that's a lesson I have to continue to remind myself mm-hmm. of, because, you know, pride and just a desire to promote myself, mm-hmm. or it's like, yeah, I've been walking with God a long time, or mm-hmm. I'm really good. And, you know, let's, as long as people don't know what goes on behind the scenes, or as long as people don't know who I really, you know, like yeah. this outward appearance is good. And so I like what you're saying there, where it's so important to see what God has really done and remind ourselves mm-hmm. of that. I think that's big purpose of the Lord's Supper, to remind ourselves of like, yeah, I need that forgiveness. I'm so thankful I've received it. And God, help me not to move away from that position and mm-hmm. use that time of remembrance mm-hmm. to bring to mind how great of a debt I've been forgiven.
Yeah. And I remember one other really influential thing. I read the book called Divine Romance by John Eldridge.
Okay.
I don't really remember a whole lot about the book. There's one chapter, and it's called Desert Communion. And I often will, when I'm teaching, will bring up the author's picture of abiding, talking about Jesus talking to his disciples about abiding in him and what that means, and how he struggled with just understanding what that concept is. And he comes to a point where he says, like, I realize that states of mind can be a place of abiding. And he talked about how he was very cynical, and how, you know, when something bad would happen, he'd turn to alcohol, or he'd turn to a movie he shouldn't be watching, or he'd just turn to just a soul, a place in his soul where he could say, you know, life stinks, mm-hmm. you know. And he realized then that that was his abiding place, that and that really resonated with me, because I was this kind of person. I'm a Gen Xer, so everything stinks, you know, like, you know, I'm a child of boomers, and I see through all the illusion of modern society, you know. And I realized that kind of like that was my abiding place too. That was that frame of reference, that that way, instead of seeing God for who he is and being with him in silence, in reading, and in prayer, I was just fine. I was cool with just being that way mm-hmm. and just being stuck in that place. Mm. I just thought that's who I was. That was my personality, you know. And God changed me through that. Like I said earlier, God used all the stuff I learned when I was in Awana clubs, and when I went to Christian school, and I went to the Bible college, and I went to seminary. None of those things were lost on me. Mm-hmm. But I just wasn't, I guess I would say it this way. I wasn't just aware of just how cosmically great God is. You know, I know he created the universe, but I didn't think about, like, he created everything we see. Like, I didn't put that into myself. I didn't allow myself to fully meditate on that, and mm-hmm. how big and how great God is. And that was part of my learning to abide in God, like seeing that I'm just this tiny fraction of this huge, big, weird, mysterious cosmic story that God is unfolding.
Right.
And that was really, like I said, within the last 10 years or so, I've really gotten a grasp of that, and seeing my place in that. And it was surrendering my attitudes and my heart to God fully. And I still struggle with it, don't get me wrong, sure. But getting to a point where like, okay, I'm not gonna play games anymore with what I allow myself to believe, what I allow myself to come in to my life, what I allow to come out of my mouth, and that kind of thing. So yeah, definitely God has used many things, mostly his word, to get me to a place where, you know, I feel more that I am surrendered to him.
Yeah. God is so loving that he doesn't require all that change all at once. He allows us to grow, and he reveals things over time where, you know, say 20 years ago, that wasn't what he wanted you to work on, even 15, but 10 years ago, that was what he had used the past experiences and growth to get you to that point where you could take those steps to grow, and how it even influences and impacts your life today is really good. I realize it might be a lengthy story, so if it's something that you can condense or consolidate, but I know at the beginning, and even when we were talking before, you mentioned how you met your wife was an important part of your story, and we haven't got to that, so I wanted to know how does that fit in, and how was that impactful in your life?
So this kind of follows like what I was talking about before. Every time that God has done something obvious and good in my life, it's when I'm not concerned about, you know, I had dated several people throughout high school and college on a serious level. Like I had four or five serious relationships. And when I came back from seminary, I was 26 years old, excuse me. And one of the pastors of the church knew I had just taken a course on apologetics and said, hey, you want to teach the college class some apologetics? I said, sure, I'd love to. I wasn't planning this. You know, I just was available. Mm-hmm. God used that. And I, you know, I'm older than my wife by 7 years, but she was a student in that class. And that's how we first met. And God used that class not only in my life, but in the lives of others. And it was because I was available and I used those things that I had learned, and it helped me to apply them better to my life. Mm-hmm. And so my wife is
available to serve God, exactly. Not just available to be dated.
Right, okay. Right. Just, exactly. I was not looking for that at all.
Okay.
And it's oftentimes when you're not, you're like, seek first the kingdom of God and all these things will be added. I wasn't looking for anything like that. I didn't find out till several years later when I attended a wedding of a friend from church that a guy who was in that Sunday school class came to know the Lord through that.
Oh, wow.
And because he's, you know, he's one of these, the church I go to is full of engineers and military people, like brainiacs, right? And so he was one of these people that needed to have questions answered, you know, sincere questions. And it was through taking a class on apologetics that I was teaching and talking about different, you know, reasons for believing that he came to know Christ. And I, you know, I didn't like have an altar call or an invitation to know Christ, but I definitely, that was like,
you laid out the gospel. Yeah,
exactly. And my wife is an MK from Japan, and she grew up there 13 years, and so she's still fluent in Japanese today, and her parents still do Japanese ministry, but here in the States,
okay,
there's a large Japanese population not too far from where we live, because there's like manufacturing, like Honda, there's a diesel engine plant, and a lot of companies send their people over to our area, so they minister to those families and their children. And so I met my wife, we started dating probably about 2 months after I first met her, and she still had to go back to school. She went to Pensacola Christian College as a graphic designer, and she does that work today. She works for Dayton Right to Life. It's a pro-life organization, and she does like all their graphic design.
Oh, cool.
So if you're ever going up 75 near the Dayton area, you see any pro-life like ads on the digital billboards, it's most likely my wife designed it. And we dated for 3 years, got married July 1st, 2006. And I'm a Chicago Bears fan. I wore their colors
today. There you go. Yeah. I thought you were coming in a whole jersey.
I was going to. I thought, you know, let me just class it up a little bit. So I have so many blue and orange clothes. It's not even funny. Shoes. But, you know, just little subtle nods. But that was the season. That was Devin Hester's rookie season.
Okay.
And I took my wife to Soldier Field for the home opener where we demolished the Lions. And I was like, I think we're going to be good this year. I think we're going to be really good because Brian Urlacher had won Defensive Player of the Year the year before, and our defense was just unbelievable. And then the special teams, probably the best of all time. And so I got her hooked. But she knew I was a Bears fan from the time she met me. I was crazy about him. But that was the year they went to the Super Bowl and lost to Peyton Manning. And but we got to the Super Bowl, and then it's just been all downhill since then.
Yeah, we've had several conversations about our poor outcome of seasons and poor outcome of fantasy teams. So, yeah. Well, I know when you find a wife, Scripture says you find a good thing, and, you know, 18 years later, it's a lot of joy there. But what would you say has been another one of those? I mean, if it is your wife, that's great. But since following Christ, and specifically as a result of following Christ, that where if you hadn't been following Christ, you wouldn't have found it. But what would you say has been one of your biggest joys?
I'd say one of my biggest joys, my daughter, who's 12. When she was born, she seemed completely normal, but she had delays and walking and speaking. And so we had, but she didn't really fully walk until she was almost three. And she walked very unsteadily for years and years and years. I mean, she's still kind of unsteady on her feet a little bit, but we had a lot of testing done, when she was little, a muscle biopsy, genetic testing. And when we did the genetic testing, they found a genetic change, but they didn't even know what it was. Like, yeah, we can see that there's a change in this gene, and we don't even have a name for it, but we notice it, we see it. And so Cincinnati Children's is one of the best children's hospitals in the country.
Yeah, it's down the road from you.
Yeah, it's very good children's hospital. And so we began seeing a lot of specialists just to kind of help see, like, we don't have a diagnosis per se, but like, are there any ways that we can help her? And just 3 years ago, we'd been seeing a neurologist from the time I think she was probably six. 3 years ago, when she was nine, we got a call saying, hey, we now have enough data on this genetic change that we kind of know what it is, and it still doesn't have a name. So the genetic change, it has a website, but it's just the name of the gene, GNA01. And you see all these there's only like several hundred cases in the United States, maybe 300 or 400. I don't know.
Wow.
And less than 1,000 worldwide, I think. It's a very rare genetic condition. And she does exhibit some of the things from that genetic change. She has low muscle tone. That was why she had a hard time walking and talking. She has fine motor problems. She doesn't have an easy time with, you know, picking up small things. And she does have cognitive delays. But I remember 2 years ago when we first looked, we first went to the website and we watched the video of all these kids and just how severely affected these kids were and how different our daughter was. Many of the kids have seizures, and that was one of the first things that the neurologist told us, is that the good news is if she hasn't had seizures up to this point, she's probably not going to. But they have seizures, and then some people have very severe muscle contractions to the point where they break their bones and they're wheelchair bound. And my daughter is neither of those things. And, you know, I don't feel lucky. I don't feel blessed in the sense that, like, oh, my daughter is better than those other kids. But I do feel like, in growing closer to God, I often ask myself, not why me, God, in the sense of, like, you know, why did you do this bad thing to me? I often find myself, why are you so good to me? Why I don't deserve to have a child who's so different, even amongst, you know, the continuum of people that have this disease. She's a very small minority who have very light conditions based on what we know so far to this point. She communicates in her own way. She talks, but because of her cognitive delays, she's not at her grade level.
Okay.
But we don't know, like, where she's going to end up. But I would say the joy that I have is, it's hard to explain, but about 4 years ago, towards the beginning of the pandemic, I remember I was doing some scripture reading in Ecclesiastes, in the section on, there's a time to kill, there's a time to heal, there's a time to cast away stones, there's a time to gather stones. And then the end of that section, it hit me for the first time. I know I've read it dozens of times, but God has set eternity on their hearts. And, it was like I said, God used all of those things that I learned earlier in my life from Awana all the way through seminary.
Yeah.
And it was like, I didn't hear an audible voice, but it was like this download of information from all the scripture that I'd learned in the past. God really spoke to me about, because I'm a person that loves experiences. I love to watch movies. I love to travel. And there's times for all of that. But if I feel like a fear of missing out, which I definitely have, God has promised and he's put eternity in my heart. Meaning, I don't believe that heaven is going to be sitting on a cloud playing a harp. I don't believe that God, that heaven is... there's things that God is going to have for us to do.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to replace the angels. Paul says we're going to judge angels. We're going to replace the angels that fell.
I've heard things that we've learned on earth more likely will be put to use. Like if you're skilled in areas, it'll be developed and grown even further.
And the promise of God that he would set eternity on our, he has put eternity in my heart, that I would not be moved by the circumstances and situations of life. That, when we got that news a year later about my daughter, which she had, I was not moved by it in the sense that, I'm moved emotionally about it, even right now. But I wasn't moved off my spot.
Yeah.
And all of these scriptures, and so it changed the way that I read the Bible and I spent time in the Word. I used to start in January with a read through the Bible program, and I'd feel guilty when I hit Leviticus, and I couldn't make it through. And definitely it's important to read all of scripture, but I moved away from that. Like, I have to accomplish this for God, into more of a meditative reading where I'll be reading through a book and I'll get stuck on a section of four or five verses. And that Ecclesiastes, that little section of verses, I was stuck on those for a long time. Because I was just wanting to really, I wanted to kind of like soak it in and really fully understand it and have it penetrate my heart. And that's kind of the way I've been, you know, meeting with God, is just like, help me to really understand, and unlike in the past, apply it to my heart and to be serious about it, not play games with it. And the one that I'm on right now, and when I say joy, and, you know, not being bogged down by situations and circumstances, is in Romans 4, the story of Abraham.
Yeah.
And the, I've been stuck on these verses for probably about 6 or 7 months. God gave Abraham a promise, and it says that Abraham didn't consider his body 100 years old and Sarah's womb that was barren, but rather he used that to strengthen his faith. And like, it's like playing, it's like doing spiritual judo. You win. It's the use of leverage. You leverage those negative things in your life, and you allow it to be something that strengthens your faith.
Yeah.
Instead of, and so when we got that news about my daughter, I was already steeped in these verses from Ecclesiastes, and I was thinking, you know, God's got a plan for her. And God has a plan for me as her dad, and my wife as her mom. And I'm not going to allow this to move me off my spot. I'm not going to allow this to question God. Like I said, there is something so cosmically big and mysterious about what God has in store, and for me to presume to know what that is all the time is just ridiculous. My mind can't hold all the information, for one thing.
Yeah.
I couldn't possibly begin to wrap my mind around all of the butterfly effect of each individual circumstance that happens in my life and what it's going to produce in the future. And there may be no earthly answer, but there will be an answer in eternity. God put eternity in my heart because not only will he heal what ails my daughter, but he'll be able to show her and everyone who has known her, including me as her dad and her mom, exactly why he wanted to do what he did.
Yeah.
And so I really get so much joy now. I'm not a masochist, right? But when something appears to be negative comes around, my first reaction isn't anymore like, oh, why this? All right. You know, look around. What's God doing in this circumstance? And, I know I've like told a really long story with that, but that's really where God has me right now and is continuing to use me. As I said earlier, I'm not perfect, and I still falter in many ways, but I would say, just like the story of Abraham, Abraham at that point in time believed, and he believed because, and this is the important part, he didn't believe in his circumstances. He believed in the God who promised. Mm-hmm. And Abraham still made lots of big blunders after that point. I mean, giving his wife away in Egypt, you know, all of, and all of the things that, the mistakes that he made, and he lied, and he, you know, he probably, you know, having a baby with his servant.
Yeah, there's a lot that Abraham did that he look at and like, it's cool that he wasn't Right. Perfect.
And you see all these people in the scriptures, and we don't want to imitate them in the ways that they fail, but we do want to imitate them in the ways that, you know, the great Hall of Faith chapter in Hebrews 11, like, these people knew that they were strangers on the earth, mm-hmm. and they knew that because not only of the brokenness of the world, but their own brokenness.
Yeah. I like how they also, you see how they, what good they did, but also when they do have those failures, mm-hmm. how they get back up, how they mm-hmm. stand back up. And like, I think that can be really helpful for all of us to look to, like, oh, mm-hmm. it's not just about being good. It's also about how you mm-hmm. get back into the place of being able to do good.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate you sharing that story. Mm-hmm. I know, like you said, it was lengthy, but there's a lot to it, and I think it's important sometimes to walk through those mm-hmm. those steps, and other people can relate more fully as a result. Whereas if you just say you have a daughter that has some mm-hmm. medical issues or mm-hmm. needs or mm-hmm. anything along those lines, like someone would be like, okay, yeah, I can kind mm-hmm. of connect. But when you mm-hmm. actually walk through and even kind of the wrestling match, I mean, mm-hmm. you know, my mind came to is often that thorn in the flesh that people refer mm-hmm. to with Paul, often is very much like, I have this thorn, like mm-hmm. I have this burden of some sort. And again, we don't know exactly what it is, but it allows us to apply it in a variety of different ways. But when you're directly responsible for caring for someone who has their own thorn, mm-hmm. It's a different perspective, because it's not just like, well, my friend has it, and so I'm there for him when I can mm-hmm. be, but this person mm-hmm. relies on you for mm-hmm. living. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's a whole different thing of being like, okay, God, you've given her this burden, this thorn. How do I help navigate her through that, and my family and myself? And I think, like Paul says, there's much joy that can result as a result of looking to Christ through those situations.
Definitely.
So as we come to a conclusion here on your story for today, mm-hmm. could you just, for anyone listening and they say, you know, I've heard your story, what would be that one thing you want them to take away? What would be that one big takeaway?
The best way to get serious about God is to be on mission. When we joined the church that we're a part of now, I had already been through all the things we're talking about, and I remember telling the pastor who was leading the new members class very distinctly. I said, we're not joining this church to sit in the pew. Mm-hmm. And that's what I would say. God has shown me his plan and made things obvious about his working in my life when I am on mission for him. And primarily that mission is, you know, spreading the gospel, but also being a part of body life in the church. I'd say to someone who thinks that it can just be them and God to rethink, just really rethink and find a church and join it. And if there's problems with the church, be a part of the solution.
Yeah.
And look for other people who are on mission, and bring them along with you, or share with them, or encourage them, pray for them. Find the people. We go to a relatively large church, you know, in several hundreds of people. So it's very easy for people to just go and be anonymous. And so my first thinking when I go into church on Sunday is like, all right, who can I bring along with me?
Yeah.
And so part of being teaching that Sunday school class is and trying to impact these young people with, like, hey, let's be on mission together. Let's obey the one another's of the scriptures. Mm-hmm. You can't be fully obedient to God outside of community.
Right. And it takes intentionality. It can't just, like you, to your point, just mm-hmm. organically happen. Sometimes mm-hmm. it does, but mm-hmm. more regularly it's someone intending to do mm-hmm. right and do good.
And you talked about communion. It's a great opportunity for us to revisit, you know, what Christ has done for us. But it's also a great opportunity, and Paul warns against being ignorant of the body. Mm-hmm. And I don't think he's talking about the bread. He's talking about, you know, some of you are sick and dying because you have neglected the body, you know, because he goes on to talk about there's some people here who don't have enough to eat, and you don't recognize these people. And so I feel like you can't be a part of what Christ and what God is doing in the world outside of community. I'd say get serious about God, get serious about being in community and being on mission, and God will do great things. You know, Paul says, I planted, Apollos watered, but God gave the increase. So don't worry about results. Don't worry about affecting change immediately. Just go pray for people, be active in the church. Don't just be active in activities, be active in getting to know and fellowshipping with and having communion with people in the body. Help them by praying for them. Help them by meeting their physical needs if necessary. And then when other people see, they're going to ask you, hey,
what's that help?
That's right, exactly. That's true apologetics, is demonstrating the life that God has for us and answering people.
Yeah.
That's different.
I think that's important, because a lot of churches have gotten away from that. It's more, over the last, you know, several decades, it's all about amassing information and being spiritually wise, but then not actually growing or exercising any muscles. It's just like, we have tons and tons of books, and we have seminars and, you know, classes and things, but like, what are you actually doing with it? So I think that's a very important message to pass along, and I appreciate you sharing it today.
Thank you.
So, well, thanks for making the trek down here and for agreeing to share your story, and I've been very encouraged as a result, so thanks again.
Thank you.
I appreciate Brad's willingness to detail some of the struggles he has endured since following Christ, including the immense weight of caring for his daughter throughout her medical challenges. The passage that enabled Brad to put his trials into perspective is found in Ecclesiastes 3:11, which says, God has made everything appropriate in its time. He has also put eternity in their hearts, but no one can discover the work God has done from beginning to end. There is a confidence that produces peace for authentic children of God because they know that God is in control and will place everything in order at the right time. You and I may never fully understand when that is or what that will look like. However, we do know that God takes care of his own and makes everything beautiful according to his timeline. Well, episode 27 is in the books. If you're not one of the over 400 people who have subscribed, consider subscribing to the Timmy Price YouTube channel. You can visit twareproductions.com to find my contact info and additional content I've produced. Have a great day, and we'll see you on the next episode of Redemption Report.